Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. And I have no news since this is part two.
Yep, it's 12:40 in the morning, and
holy crap, it is. Jeez.
Yep.
Yeah, we did have that delay. Somebody's computer failed.
Yeah, what a jerk.
Yeah. And this episode will be about 13th Age. So those of you who tune in to listen to our 10 to 15 minute banter about, just about anything, the wit.
Both of you are going to be very disappointed.
I wanted to learn more about 80s movies.
I wanted to practice my Sean Connery accent.
Yeah, you'll get plenty of Sean during this episode, I promise you.
There will never be a lack of Sean again.
But we're actually going to launch right into our review of 13th Age. Mm. And we'll probably get a lot of emails saying, hey, you know that when you launched right into it, why don't you do more of that?
Yeah. Or hey, you know that where you review new games? How about you do that too?
Remember that 8 years between a release and your review of Savage Worlds?
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Yeah, don't do that.
Hey, really excited about your review of Pathfinder.
Which is actually coming up soon.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you guys beat the second edition. So. All right. Overall impression of 13th Age. For people who didn't listen to part one, what we'll do with the review, it is a book read review, not a play review. We haven't had a chance to play 13th Age. It's going to be divided. We'll give our overall impressions of the game, and we'll break it down between system setting and art and writing or presentation. And then we'll finish with either a strong recommendation, a conditional recommendation, or a no recommendation.
Right.
So what you guys think? Chris?
I really, really like 13th Age. I think it's, if I had to can it all together in one thing, I'd say it's D&D 4.5, but it's a really well done, it's what 4E should have been. Yeah, all of the criticisms I had about 4E, it cleans up, and it adds in a couple of new features that, more than a couple, new features that are fun, interesting, and it looks like a really good game. I wish this had been there when we started playing 4E instead of 4E.
I pretty much have the same impression, although I am looking forward to hearing what rules it cleans up and when we get to it, Chris. But overall, yeah, I think pretty much the same thing. This is what 4th edition wanted to be, and I probably would have enjoyed playing 13th Age a lot more than I did playing 4E.
Wow, I think Chris, I think you summed it up, and Wayne as well. My own thoughts. I would say, here's what I think might happen in the future if 13th Age supports this product, is that when D&D Next comes out, there'll be a triple fracture. Those people that are just devoted to the name Dungeons and Dragons will follow them. Those people who really love what they did with 3.5. will stay with Pathfinder. And those people who really like what they did with 4E will then fracture over to 13th Age.
I could see that. Yeah.
Because absolutely. I think it... I can't say anything better than Chris. This is 4.5 D&D.
Yeah.
All right. So I think a lot of things... And, it's both a criticism and a plus, I suppose, of 4E is the emphasis on the system. Mm-hmm. So let's start off with the system for 13th Age. What did you guys think of it?
Okay, well, the best way to go into the rules, I think, for myself anyway, is in comparison to 4E, because that's basically how I looked at the book. But there were a lot of things that were cleaned up. Some of the problems that I had in 4E was that the combats were very long, and there was an overemphasis on conditions, for example, like slow and blind and, deafened, weakened, things like that. That the stack-ons of conditions got overwhelming at times.
Right.
The power system, where each character class was basically turned into a wizard. Everybody had a selection of powers that were basically like spells that they would just cast when in combat. So there didn't feel so much of a difference between playing a wizard or a fighter or whatnot, at least not mechanically.
Right.
Thematically, of course, there was plenty of difference. And all of those things have been addressed in this book. Some of the things that they've created now, for example, are an escalation
die. I was going to say that. I really like that.
Yeah. And is it each round, Lyle? Or rather, each turn?
From what I read, the escalation die, it's a d6, and starting on turn 2 of the combat,
that's right.
You set it at 1, and then it increases in value every turn, unless the GM feels that the players are not engaging in combat, and the momentum they gained would kind of peter off.
Can you just back up a bit? So the escalation die is based on the ideas, like you kind of get warmed up. So you start combat cold, and as you fight through both getting warmed up in the combat and also your tactical sensibilities, you've set up, you're building off of each other, and you've set things up each round,
right?
Then you get a bonus. And it caps out at +6, but after the first round, you get like a +1, +2, +3. They recommend, I actually have one of these D6, where it's a massive D6, and you use that, but if not, you take a cup and put a sad little die on top of it. And you do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up into 6. But as Wayne says, if the players are very passive or defensive, and it's not, you can't really justify them as setting up a tactical attack,
right,
then it actually can go down. And they say if you don't want to use this rule, then all the creatures that they have, then put them at -1, because they've already built it into the creatures, is that they're going to be a little tougher at first, and then as you get warmed up and as you set up sort of or use your tactical sensibilities, it's going to get easier to beat them. And I think this may, if I can say, Chris, it's going to touch upon what you're saying, is that the 4E combats went a little bit long.
Exactly.
This is giving a little bit is understatement.
This gives a mechanical justification for speeding it up. And I thought it was, and I said this in the part one, when we talk about Numenera, I said elegant. It makes a lot of sense to me. I like it. I like the fact that they anticipate that people might not want to use it and then say how you cannot use it. And that didn't feel like they weren't committed to it. They felt like they were very much committed to it. In fact, in this rule, they said, why wouldn't you want to use this? But then they said, you know, if you don't...
Just in case, here you go. And a lot of different kinds of powers build off of this mechanic. For our monsters. And it's, all around. It's one of the things that made combat feel slow in 4E is a lot of the different kinds of powers you have are limited to a daily, once per day use, or once per combat, once per encounter use, and then kind of every turn you can use. And one, if you have a longer combat, you run out of your daily and encounter powers pretty quick, and you're just left with kind of these little weak ones that you can peter again and again at them, just spamming it. And this is one way that even if you run out of the bigger ones, your smaller attacks still are going to count for more because you're getting these bonuses to it. So, it's a beautiful way of cleaning up one of the biggest problems there was with 4E, in my humble opinion.
I'm going to say this now in case I forget to say it later on in the episode, in that I really felt like this was, we didn't even say their names. I think primarily it was Jonathan Tweet and Rob Heinso. So those two. I really felt like rather than being a system by committee, it was these guys getting together. And there's actually parts in this book where they disagreed on something. So there's like, here's what you can do with our disagreement. Here's what one person thinks. Here's what the other person thinks.
And right. We have different play styles at this point. So here's how he plays it. Here's how I play it.
And I really liked it. It really felt like, you know, and I was a fan of the system of Numenera. I really felt like a professional's idea of here's what I think would be a good game.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the escalation die, it's just one of those things. It's like, you know, I always house ruled this into my 4E games. Mm-hmm. I think it should be part of your game.
Yeah. That's the same feeling I got.
Honestly, that is what I expect from a game system. I expect it to feel coherent. And as you guys said, I like how there are little call-outs and sidebars where the designers disagree. But it's just, like, interesting where they can say, you know, here is what we agreed on for the book, and that's what we're going to stick to. But just in case you're wondering, here's how one of us does it a little bit differently. And here's why. And, yeah, that's rather than clutter up the book with a whole lot of optional rules that, you know, kind of make it feel a bit disjointed and whatnot. It's like, nope, this is what the game is, and here's how we run it when we do.
Yeah, pay attention, D&D Next, because they do a really good job throughout. And we'll talk about more about that later, but anything else?
Well, I am glad to hear that the escalation die has triggers, because perhaps I hadn't really noticed that, but I like what the escalation die does. It certainly does seem like it is designed to speed up those 4E style combats. Nice to see that there are things that trigger on it.
Yep.
Because it reminded me a little bit of the Doom Pool from Marvel Heroic, where here's another resource for the game, and it's just nice to know that more is done with it than that bonus.
I actually read a interview with one of the key designers, and he doesn't see systems as being limits on role playing, but he understands that some people would view it that way. And he was trying to go, or they were trying to go with this one being a little bit more narrative. And he sees this as, he was talking about, you know, D&D is a child of war games. Mm-hmm. And indie games were like a reaction to that, but not necessarily always a successful reaction. Mm-hmm. And he sees this as like, you know, a hybrid of rules that people can use and give them information, and, you know, it's all about telling a story where you don't go, yes, I hit him. It's more like, yes, we're telling a great story here. Mm-hmm. And I see this in these rules and what Wayne was talking about right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Other things that I liked about it, the character classes still have powers similar to 4E, but the powers are mostly, not entirely, centered on the character. For example, fighters' powers, they allow the fighter to buff themselves and to take on different styles of fighting rather than putting effects on the enemy. Whereas a cleric's powers are more about... Whereas a wizard spells or a bard spells, they affect the enemy more directly, kind of they're projecting power onto them. Same thing for a rogue is like the fighter. They do tricks that allow them to maneuver and do extra damage instead of just adding conditions onto the enemies that you're fighting against. The characters are also sorted really, really well in that they have the simplest one, the barbarian, which is for somebody who just wants to roll dice and see if they hit or not. Hmm. And then they go all the way up in complexity till you get to the wizard, where in combat you're kind of crafting your own spells, coming up with the effects on the fly while you're in combat. And so it's a very different level of difficulty, but also it suits whatever different kind of player that you want to be.
Right. I guess thinking about 4E, because, again, I think it's fair to compare these two games. While the character classes in 4E were balanced to the point of overbalance, in my opinion, none of them were really more or less difficult than the others because of how they were built. And yeah, a common criticism is, hey, you turned them all into wizards because they all have the same number of dailies, at wills, and encounter powers, and they're all about the same complexity. So again, it's nice to see them kind of step back from that and say, hey, here's a really simple character, you know, the barbarian, you just want to hit stuff. Well, here's a really kind of complex character with the wizard and all the things you can do, and they still work inside the system we've provided, but they're different levels of complexity. But that doesn't mean you can't have them both together in the same party. And again, not to harp on D&D Next, but a lot of the things that I've seen that they're trying to do with D&D Next is have both simple and complex characters and character options in the same game and in the same party. And I don't know if you can do that, I don't know if you can have some people choosing feats while other people just take a flat ability score bump and still have things work out and maintain that balance. But again, I think 13th Age has done a pretty good job of saying, well, you can within certain tolerances.
No, I mean, it's a good point. I mean, something that we should point out is in the overview of each class, the first they have some flavor text, and then the first thing they say is playstyle. Mm-hmm. So just as Chris said, the barbarian is for a beginner player who doesn't want a lot of options or to do think, whereas a bard are flexible characters with many mm-hmm. options in role-playing situations and in combat. They're not the best character choice for beginner players, but can be a lot of fun for experienced and extroverted players who enjoy mastering blah, 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 blah. And I think that's great. You know, that exactly. that helps not only an inexperienced or semi-experienced game master when introducing new people to the game, but it can also be somebody who picks it up and they readable play style and they kind of get a feel as like, yeah, I kind of maybe wanted to play the bard, but yeah, I mean, if the barbarian's less complicated, maybe I'll go with them. So, mm-hmm.
yeah. Other things that I thought were cool, going with character creation, one of the nifty bits that they have in character creation is that every character gets to choose one unique thing about themselves, which is not supposed to affect mechanics. It's only based on story. So I thought that was a nifty thing to throw in.
Yeah, that was nice to encourage that. And I think what's really great about this book is they give you a lot of examples.
Mm-hmm. Tons.
Yeah. And not only examples from one person, but they'll have Rob's examples and Jonathan's examples.
Mm-hmm. And they actually get really far into it because they say that it's not supposed to affect your character mechanically. You're not supposed to be able to use this unique thing to steal extra skill points or something. But they also say if somebody really wants their unique thing to affect the character's stats, then it's okay, but take away one of their other powers or exchange it. And they gave some examples of that, like one guy said his unique thing is, I'm the only elf in the world who has wings. And like, you know, that's a little bit overpowered, right. So here's how we handle it in this situation. And yeah, it's so flexible. It's really nice.
They also do organize the one unique things by kind of how they affect the world, where like one of the categories is, you know, players creating the story. Another one is like, you know, cool ideas now, consequences later. They have ones that are like seemingly, you know, innocuous and mm-hmm. yeah, that too much for level one, you know, or
yeah, and they say you can add to it,
right?
Mm-hmm. Which is great, but yeah, you're absolutely right, and they give you a really clear example. What's too much for level one? You're like, well, there's already an archmage, you know,
yeah. Right? And I guess touching back to our Numenera example, one unique thing is what I expected the parts of a Numenera character to be more like.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Wayne. Yes, totally.
So, again, I look at the one unique thing and they're great. They're open. They don't, or they're not intended to affect mechanics. And they address this in the book, but I do see players running into the blank page problem sometimes, you know, where the counterpoint to being constrained by lists is having too much freedom and not knowing what to pick or freezing up.
Very true, very true.
So we almost have two, not we almost, we do have two extremes here between 13th Age and Numenera, where this one is pick from a list and 13th Age is anything you want. So I kind of like the way they contrast each other. I do like one unique things better.
Agreed. One thing that I was kind of on the fence about, and I actually wanted to ask your guys' opinion, is how they do the backgrounds rather than skills. In 13th Age, your character, instead of having skills, you have a background, which is, for example, I was a ranger for 5 years with the Elven Eastern Forest Corps. Obviously, I'm making that up right now.
Right.
Or I was a spy for the kingdom or something like that. So when you come across the skill check, for example, climbing a wall, instead of saying I have the climb skill at +3, you would say I have, you know, a spy for the king at +3. And that obviously would have me climbing walls, so I should get a bonus here.
You know,
what do you guys make of that?
When I first read that, I didn't like it. Mm-hmm. I thought it was kind of, not power gamey is perhaps the wrong word, but open to abuse. And then just now, as you were saying that, I realized, hey, those are no different than aspects in Fate. And you, you know, kind of finagling the situation or explaining narratively how these things apply, they're aspects. They work almost exactly the same as aspects, and I have no problem with aspects. So why was my initial knee-jerk reaction that these were broken when they're not? So now I have come to the conclusion that I have no problem with them. So
yeah, I'm going to agree with Wayne. I think some of the problems that people have with traditional D&D is you start at first level and you're, what, plus one better than everybody else. So you have, what's the point of writing a background? Yeah. So you're a veteran of many wars, but you don't have fieldcraft. What?
Yeah.
And I think that's what it does. I mean, I sure in 3.5 or Pathfinder, you could write down that your profession is soldier, and I actually did that with my character just to cover all that stuff because I had it in my background. Yeah. And I think this is just a nice way to do it. And I think it also, just the kind of player I am, I'm not more of a background or a backstory. I'm sort of a story as you go. And sometimes you'll think of something, you know, I mean, you could be like five levels in, you think of something, you know, this would be great for my background. Yeah. And this kind of allows for it and allows for that kind of give and take.
Yeah, and specifically it does say you can you don't have to choose these right away when you begin. You can choose it later
on. And it encourages people to have a background, and anything that encourages people to think about who their character is a good thing.
So. Well, I was going to say, like, I don't know if they say this in the book, but provided you come up with like a couple background packets, for lack of a better term, because they're not skills, right? Provided you come up with a few of those to cover your 8 points at character creation, well, there's no reason that through play you could realize, oh, like, I can actually do all these things because of my background. I didn't really know what it meant to be an Imperial Mage when I wrote it down, but I did. And now that we've kind of through play solidified a bit more about what it means to be an Imperial Mage, that opens up all these other areas that I can apply this background check to. So it's not even you have to change your background or add or subtract actual points to a background through play. You could just realize, now we know more about what this does, and now I can do more with it, you know, just because of the way the narrative has worked out.
And it gives ammunition to the GM to actually expand in that direction. Hopefully something that the players are interested in because they made it up themselves.
Right. And similar to that one unique thing, those backgrounds that players create can create little bits of the world. Great. We didn't have a, you know, Tooth of the Black Fang. I don't know what that is. Tell me about it. What is it? Oh, great. Yeah. Now I'm going to write that down and put it in my world. And now we have this little bit that, because of your character's background, you now added to the world. Thank you.
Okay. Other stuff I thought was pretty cool is specifically from the DM's side of the table. They have things for impromptu damage and unfair encounters, ways to the combat in the system. Monster stats are very much focused around making combats dramatic rather than tactical, I suppose would be a way of describing it. The monsters, they have different kinds of monsters for mooks, which is same as minions in 4E, just crowds of smaller monsters that you can go through really easily. Monsters that have final attacks on death, you know, just in a movie when the dead monster lashes out that one last time. Special effects that trigger on different parts of battle. Really, really simplistic monster stats. They're only a few lines long, so you can make up monsters on the fly really easily. It's just, to GM this game would be a lot of fun because it gives you so many options and tools in a nice streamlined package that you can focus on so much more on the story than on the numbers. And I really like it.
I thought you would like that, Chris, because, again, you ran a 4E game, and I remember one encounter you tried to do that boss fight where the boss had three different stages to try and mix up the battle and make it more dramatic. And I'm pretty sure, Lyle, you and I both agreed where we saw no difference at all between these three stages. We didn't even know you were doing it. It felt absolutely no different. So, yeah, what you've said about running the game and how encounters are specifically focused to be dramatic rather than tactical. I thought you would really like that.
Very much so, yeah. And I guess finally, the only quibble I had with the rules is just that there's quite a bit of math that goes into making a rule. You do your d20 plus your ability modifier plus your level plus the number of points in the background plus any optional or different bonuses versus the DC. So there's a lot of factors to add together to get your roll up there. So I thought that was a little bit eh, but whatever. There's so many other good things about it that it's hard to take that away.
Well, honestly, is it any more or less complex than 4E or 3.5?
Yes, it is more complex because the 4E math, more so than the 3E math, is so categorized and set that usually you'll have the bonus, the totaled bonus, written down somewhere beforehand for yourself. And you wouldn't have to actually look at different things to add them together. Whereas in this one, well, I suppose the ability modifier... Now, you still have to choose which ability it is for what's happening around it, because there aren't set skills. Your level's not going to change, but also what background is applicable here will change based on the situation. So it's not at all too much, but yeah. Yeah, it's not too much. So it's a very, very minor thing.
I guess since we're talking about combat, this kind of goes full circle back to speeding up the combats. And correct me if I'm wrong, but when an attack or when a damage notation says you do weapon damage,
the computer,
on the hands of a player character, each weapon attack deals one die of damage per character level. So, again, I like how that speeds up combat, mm-hmm. simply because, you know, the higher level you get, the more damage you are going to dish out on a hit. And, We've said it before in our 4E thing. That was my beef with the game. The combats took too long. And even at higher levels, you were still swinging for, you know, normal...
Yeah, 1d6 points.
Yeah, exactly, 1d6 points. Once your powers had been depleted. And I never really... I think when the designers created 4E, they were going for a meaningful choice. You know, hold on to your daily power... and maybe run up against something that you can use it, or use it now and risk running up against something worse later. But that's never really how it worked. It never felt tense at all. Mm. It just kind of drug the combat out. You're like, oh, great, we're down to at wills, and isn't this going to be fun while we duke it out for another 2 hours?
I think this plays into their idea of magic items, where they always want magic items to feel special. Your level actually plays into the number of magic items that you can have without incurring penalties. Mm-hmm. So it's something they recommend. I believe it's half the number of levels between the number of levels is the number of magic items that you should have. Mm-hmm. So having that rule that of damage, I think it has a nice synergy with that idea. Is that, I mean, what a lot of times you pick magic items just so you can have that additional damage bonus. Mm-hmm. Just to get through the combats or just to sort of represent your character. But why do you need something external to represent your character? Your character is what it is. I mean, you should be able, you know, when you strip Riddick or you strip Rambo or you strip these characters down and take away all their items, they're still that good. Hmm. And that kind of rule plays into that and plays into what they think with magic items. And I really, really like that. I mean, I like that they think about things like that. And that you can, Wayne can talk about damage, and I can immediately think about the rule from the magic items and see how those connect immediately.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's something that I kind of missed, well, not even in 4E, but even in 3E, is how disposable magic items were. You know, I always like the magic items to be really special. And this way is a way that you can keep your magic items throughout your character's life. It can grow to have a personality of its own, like Excalibur or something along those lines.
Without tacking on a whole lot of extra rules to do so.
Exactly. So yeah, that pretty much clears up my list. Sorry, there's a lot there, but there's a lot about the system this game that impressed me.
Well, as we said, it seems as if this was not seems that it this was obviously written to be a coherent whole, you know, by a small group of people who probably shared the same vision of what this game should be.
Yeah, and I mean, people who like 4E, for example, I like the Eladrin, the teleport, and they have high elves who teleport. So they have kept some things from 4E, and I think it's one of you who said that one of the things about D&D Next is they seem to be throwing 4E under the bus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like the Bush presidency. They just don't want to remember it.
Right, but it's not like 4E was a horrible system. So it does have its fans, and I think this really respects that. I mean, they're trying to do a better game, but they're not denying that 4E ever existed.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I had a lot of problems with 4E, but as I said before, I would never run it again as a game master, but I'd be perfectly happy to play it as a player again. And there were some really good aspects to it, but yeah, this is just a much better evolution of it. It's a shame that Wizards is just dumping it instead of improving on it.
Well, as Lyle said in the beginning, if 13th Age continues to be supported, you're going to have a three-way fracture.
Yeah. If I were Wizards, I'd just buy it. I'd buy the system and say, sorry, we're not going to do D&D Next anymore. This is what we're going to do. It'll never happen, but...
Right. All right, move on to setting.
And that's their big thing. I at least the way they introduce the game. They talk about these things called icons. They run from the fairly generic to somewhat creative. So you have things like the Dwarf King, the Elf Queen, the Archmage. Okay. Mm-hmm. You would imagine any world having those. And that's not me giving a general or generic title to these. That's the actual titles in the game.
Right.
Two, the Prince of Shadows, the Three, which turns out to be three dragons.
The Great Gold Dragon.
Yes. And the three would be other...
Tiamat, basically.
Yeah. So the blue, the black, and the red dragons. Mm-hmm. And these aren't necessarily gods, though. These are, icons or iconic characters, iconic NPCs in the game.
Yep. Kind of the movers and shakers of the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yeah. What'd you guys make of those? Like, when I first read it, the book opens with these icons, and it actually threw me. At first, I was like, this system is crap. You know, here's this important part that's built into the system, but what if I don't like these icons? You know, then I'm stuck with them and these rules and blah, I don't like it. But the more I read about them, actually, the more I started to like them.
I was the same as you. You flip to it, and I generally flip the introduction stuff where they talk about what was a role-playing game and here was my thought process making this game. So I skip to these guys. I'm like, wow, like the Dwarf King, the Elf Queen, the Lich King?
How about some better
Orc
names?
Orc Lord? Come on. Yeah, exactly. How about some better names? And what am I supposed to do with these? I mean, it really seemed like...
out of place, like it should come later in the book?
Sure, out of place, or just not very creative and very generic. And I'm like, is this a very generic game? And then I went back and when we were preparing for the review, and then went back to the beginning of the book and read what their concept was for these icons. And they said, if there's one thing you can take away from this book and plop into another game, it's these icons, because that's the way they were designed. And then when you kind of get that rationale and you read them and you're like, yeah, some of these are really creative. And, I see, you're giving me ideas on how to interact with these movers and shakers and how this is going to immediately affect me. It's like a pantheon that is more immediate.
Yes.
And I really like the idea, and I could really see how this is both shaping the setting in this game, but it's also something that I can immediately take out and plop into any game, because then they later on, they do an alignment matrix and show you where everybody is on that.
Right.
So you can plop it in, and I think it would enrich any, certainly, Dungeons & Dragons game, because it would be very easy to drop it in. Mm-hmm. But it's then immediately make somebody, and again, a beginner player, they would like go through this and they go, okay, I kind of get how I'm supposed to interact with these guys.
Yeah, it elevates the player characters into people who are not the most important people in the world, but they are very important because they deal with those who are the most important people in the world. And yeah, it has the potential to completely change the setting around the characters based on their own actions and interactions with these ones. And it's great because with the matrix, it balances out too. One of the icons may be very pleased with you, but the other one might be angry. And so you get benefits on one hand and negatives on the other.
Well, there's two matrices. The one I talked about with the alignment, and the one Chris is talking about where you...
Your favorite?
Yeah, you put points into how you relate to them.
Mm-hmm. Right, I think you can choose positive, conflicted, or negative.
Yep.
Yes.
And again, I mean, they've really committed to the icons. They're like, this and the one unique thing is really what's setting this game apart from others.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they did a good job with that. It's the... There was the alignment matrix, and the other one is the icon relationships master chart.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And as Wayne said, positive, conflicted, and negative relationship.
It's, you know, I wanted to do something similar to Game of Thrones in a fantasy game, and this is how you would do it. Take the people like the Lannisters and the Starks and make them the icons, and then you can integrate your characters into that world so easily. Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I didn't think of that, but I think that's a really good example of how you can... Not even take these icons, but take the icon concept,
right, mm-hmm.
and put it into your game.
That's what I took away from it, is that not that the icons themselves are what I'd want to use. Not to say that they're not interesting at all, because they are very, very interesting and varied. But yeah, just the way to use the icons is a fantastic thing to put into any game. So even for just that concept and those rules, it's worth looking into this system.
Absolutely, yeah. You could totally reskin them as houses from, you know, Song of Ice and Fire or factions. Or you're talking about like Planescape, because Monte Cook, you know, who wrote Numenera, wrote Planescape. Aren't those the factions in Planescape?
Yep.
You know, the Dustmen, the whatever.
Yep.
Hey, there's your icons right there. It's not one person; it's the organization.
Yeah. And if you're going into an epic style game, maybe on the Planescape level, then go ahead, make them the gods. That's perfectly fine.
Yeah, I can see that.
They actually say that in the book. They talk about. Some people think these are gods. I don't have it in front of me, but I think they say, well, they're not really, but hey, you can certainly play them as gods. Mm-hmm. Nothing to stop you, because it's all there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this between the background skills and the icons and the, I suppose, a unique thing as well, but
right.
You could really put this into a political game very easily, more so than you could, well, not so more so than you could with other games, but it gives you the tools there.
Right, right. I was going to say, since we're talking about setting, yeah, all... Three of those things, the icons, the one unique thing, and the background packages, again, for lack of a better term, the game doesn't need a setting. You know, again, this is kind of contrasted with Numenera, where there isn't really a setting provided in 13th Age. It's just kind of like standard fantasy tropes that everybody is familiar with. But because of those three things, icons, one unique thing, and background... A setting comes with the game whenever you play, and it'll be a new one depending on which players you play with. And you can go the route where you detail the setting beforehand and lay out who the icons are, you know, major organizations in the world, and then players can pick things for their characters based on what you've prepared. Or you can do it the flip side, where, okay, you guys make your characters... And now I'm going to use the things you gave me to construct the world. So, my play style, I like that.
I mean, they do have a gazetteer in the book, but they say, you know, if you decide to use our world instead of a world you've already got cooking, don't treat our map as restrictive.
Yep.
So even what they've provided for a gazetteer is designed to be placed into whatever world you're playing.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, pick whatever you can. But for somebody who's picking this game up for the first time, like or picking this game up and it's the first game they've ever picked up, yeah, you can certainly use it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a little bit apologetic when they do the monsters and say, hey, we're covering the classic monsters. In future supplements, we're gonna come up with some new stuff. But right now, we're just in the monsters that you know. So
it's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I just, they're very, very upfront why they're doing it. So
yeah. Well, they didn't set out to reinvent the wheel. They set out to make a better wheel, and so they're keeping with the traditional fantasy, and that keeps to the monsters. And again, the way they did the monsters is very, very nice. It's they're very easy to use for a GM, at least without having playtested it, of course. But yeah, well done.
No, and again, I know we weren't comparing the two, but I'm going to anyway. Again, between Numenera, where everything in the creature section for Numenera is pretty much completely fantastical, where you don't really know what it is. And, okay, the exploration is supposed to be the theme of the game, but my opinion, that kind of works against the game, where 13th Age, yeah, here are the classic monsters. You know what a dragon does. You know what an orc does. You know what all these monsters do because you've encountered them before. Where Numenera is, here's this thing whose name I can't pronounce and I don't really know what it is or how to use it. So I don't really have an idea of what kind of world you're presenting because, hey, it just seems like everything. And I don't know. I like the 13th Age approach much better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me that's apples and oranges. Okay. Because in Numenera, I thought the art is absolutely fantastic. They're trying to present very unfamiliar creatures, and I think they did a good job. And here they're trying to present the familiar, and I think they did all right too.
Fair enough. Although I wasn't necessarily talking about the art, just
but I mean not the, knowing I what mean, the thing was. Yeah. For Numenera, I think it's difficult to separate the art from the thing. And especially in a monster section or a creature section of a book, right. I think mm-hmm. the pictures of the monsters, and I didn't want to touch on it too much right now because I was saving it for the art, but I think, in my opinion, one of the weaknesses of 13th Age is they only provide icons for the monsters, yeah, and that's great for somebody who already knows who the monsters are. But right. I really like a core book to be something for the first-time gamer, and unfortunately... Mm-hmm. And I agree with Chris, is that the actual description of the monsters or the actual information that they provide as far as to play it is nice and concise and useful. But if you don't know what the monsters is, you don't have that picture to reference. What they have for people who haven't seen it is it's almost as if they've mounted the head on a hunter's trophy or hunter's plaque.
Yeah, the demon section especially. Yeah.
But even that, and that's actually the best of them too. The I think the golem is just like a triangle. The stone golem is a triangle with stone cracks in it, and the flesh golem is a triangle that has stitches across it.
Right.
And I think the ice giant was just a triangle with the silhouette of the head of an ice giant, which is a guy with a beard.
Hmm.
And like right next to it is human, and it's just the silhouette of a person's face on a triangle.
Right.
So it's different from the rest of the book. The monster's art is not that great.
Well, since we're talking about it, we might as well get into art. Mm. So
yeah, let's.
And you said something interesting about, well, maybe not interesting, but you said something about the art, Lyle.
Well, with the monsters, is that doesn't really tell me what the monster is from the art. And I do think if you're going to spend money on the art, I want to see the characters and I want to see the monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I would want to see more, but at least those. I would say overall the art is passable.
Agreed.
Yeah.
They kind of took a page out of a 3.5 where they did a lot of sketch style drawings in there.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I really like the style, but again, it's not... I like the style, but I don't think the final product is as good as it could have been.
No, absolutely. I mean, if you look at something out of the 80s, this would be a slick product, but now, no.
Yeah, especially with products out there. Like, actually... talking about 4E, the 4E monsters manuals were amazing. Every creature had a picture, and it was a really well-done picture. And also Pathfinder, the character pictures in there are just fantastic.
I would say Pathfinder is probably one of the best books for art in that there's really good pictures of the characters. Of course, pictures of the monsters if you get into the bestiary. But the chapter pictures, I mean, the two-page spreads, it really sells adventure to me.
Yeah, doesn't it? It makes you just want to dive into a fantasy world.
Yeah, and I think if there's a weakness in 13th Age, it's the art, in that the art doesn't draw me into their world.
I remember you saying that before, and I didn't really know what you meant. And then I went through and looked through the book again, and I agree with you. Like, in my opinion, nothing is wrong with the style of the art, but except for perhaps the cover, which I know you don't really care for all that much, Lyle. My feeling is none of the images tell a story. They're just kind of like a picture.
Yeah.
And they don't really draw you into that sense of adventure where, the two-page spread of the opening chapter of the Pathfinder book, something was always happening in that picture. And you're like, wow, what is going on in there? I don't know, but
yeah, where
that,
is that
looks cool. Yeah. Something is happening and wouldn't it be cool to kind of join in on whatever it is they're doing? Where, the 13th Age art is technically nice. It looks fine. Nothing wrong with it. But it's passive. And, it does not draw you into that sense of adventure.
Yeah, I'm looking at the icons right now. And again, we're fans of the icons. But yeah, I'm looking at the art, and it's like they have the great gold worm, and there's, I suppose,
a little strip of its eyes.
Yeah, like a close-up of its face, and then there's the emperor, and there's a close-up of him on the throne. Elf Queen, sort of a close-up of her. And I don't see her in any context, and I don't see the emperor in any context. I suppose if you read the background with the great gold worm, the context is difficult, but let's say all the other ones. How about showing me the emperor on the throne with people around him and people interacting with him? Like, make me want to be in that throne room. Yeah. And the Elf Queen, she rules the Court of Stars. Show me in this Court of Stars. Maybe not in the icon picture, but show me somewhere else in the book of her there. And one thing that's a little bit different from the traditional fantasy is that the Dark Elves don't seem to be pariahs.
Right.
They could be evil, but I mean, it's open, so it's sort of like a post-Dritz world.
Well, they're still all cruel because of
their
power.
Cruel, yeah, but they're not. I mean, they've opened it up as like, you want to play a Dark Elf? Go ahead.
No, I should point out that the same images they use for the icons do appear as full page images throughout the book.
Yeah, but I'm looking at the High Druid.
They're not necessarily the chapter headings, and that's certainly not saying that they are more active because of the same images. So I just didn't want people to think that they're only like small images is what we're getting. We're getting full page ones, but as Lyle said, there's not any action or context in these images. And
the High Druid, you see more of her, and it's just more of her. Oh, and there's an owl.
Right.
And it's autumn because leaves are falling, but that's not telling me anything about her. Like, who does she fight? Have her fight something. Have somebody interact with her. You know, we could, how about having some icons together? So
yeah, that would be cool.
So I think as far as the layout goes, it's very much a slightly less colorful 4E.
Yeah, right. I think they use the same font for 4E too, and the same table style for it.
Yeah.
What about the writing? I actually like the writing and the fact that, and we've touched on a bit, where we say when they disagree with something, they write it in. It's very just folks. Hey, it's just me talking to you,
right?
I like.
Mm. Did you ever read Dresden Files?
Yes.
Yeah, it's very similar to that. It keeps itself in world, but at the same time, it's also it doesn't have much of a fourth wall. The author talks directly to you, and in this case, the author is the game designer.
Wasn't Dresden Files a little jokey?
It was. And I take it back. They didn't have the game designers talking to you. They had characters from the Dresden universe as game designers talking to you.
Right.
So it was a werewolf explaining why he put this rule into the game. But at the same time, it was still kind of that lack of a fourth wall, even though it was a werewolf. Yeah. But yes, something like this is the same, where they have asides where they go into why we did this, where we disagreed, as we've already mentioned. But yeah, it is good.
No, I really like that. I think it makes the game a little bit easier to follow.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the Dungeon Master's Guide for 4E was perhaps the best Dungeon Master's Guide of them all. It really was like, hey, I'm talking to you as one Dungeon Master to another, and just really trying to explain stuff in that regard. And I think 13th Age does a lot of that, and I think that's great for both an experienced and a new player. If I was going to have one criticism, it's that sometimes they seem to be talking to somebody who's played 3rd Edition before or 4th Edition. Like, talking to an experienced person, because a reference is like, well, in 3rd Edition we saw it as this way, but now we don't think that's going to work. And you're like, well, don't talk about another edition or another game. Just tell me why you wanted to do it this way for this game without referencing other games.
Don't they start off at the very beginning of the book, though, to say that we assume you've played other games? I don't have the PDF downloaded.
No, I mean, they do say it's like about 3rd Edition and 4th Edition. And I just think this style works really well with a beginner game master and throughout most of the book.
Mm-hmm.
You could have a beginner game master use this, and their style, like this talking directly to you, I think is really helpful. I just sometimes, and I might be even nitpicking here, they'll refer to one of the other versions of Dungeons & Dragons and then say, this is why we did it that way, but we want to do it this way. And then they also talk about grognards and things like that. But if somebody doesn't know what a grognard is, that doesn't mean anything. So for the most part, I think they're right. They strike a really good balance between talking to the beginner and the experience, and then sometimes they lean more towards the experience. And I wish they wouldn't have done that, because I think this would be a great book to recommend to first-time gamers and first-time game masters.
Yeah.
Because of that style, because they talk and they give endless examples. The one unique thing, they're just like, Rob's like, here's my examples. And Jonathan's like, here's Jonathan's examples. And then they'll have a rule. Then they're like, here's the rule. But you know something? Jonathan never uses this rule.
Yeah. This is how I break it, and this is how he breaks it.
And you're like, character's dying. And I think whatever. But Jonathan thinks only villains should be able to kill player characters. Mm-hmm. So I have the rule. I know what the rule is. But I'm like, oh, here's a really popular house rule. Mm-hmm. So as a beginner, I would go, yeah, I'm gonna go with this. But it's good to know. Maybe I might want to opt to only have the villains do it. So I'll see how the game goes.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember when I was, you know, 15 yeah. years old and I had that that sudden epiphany, like, what? I can make my own world? Awesome. But, you know, this kind of lets you know from the very beginning that house ruling is okay.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah. Oh, like, I remember the example, one of the ones, when they're talking about traps and they're talking about why they don't want traps to, like, kill off players. And if they cut out all the references to the other previous games, it still makes sense. I just wish they didn't have the reference. And like, well, in the past, you know, traps were like this. And really dangerous. Well, who cares? Just say...
Well, I'm sure the Grognards care.
Yeah, I suppose. But, I mean, they could have said, I don't think traps should kill off players.
Right.
Big parts of the story should kill off players. Traps should be a nuisance. Traps should be an interruption. But traps shouldn't be a major part of the story. You know, and I when you read that and you're like, you're thinking of the trash compactor. And it's like, oh, God, we lost hand to the trash compactor. What?
Yeah.
What? One unique thing. It was like, how did it help me in that pit of spikes?
Yeah, right. My unique thing should have been impervious to spikes.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, so yeah. It's like, it's my background. I'm very calloused. Very calloused. You got that?
I can see one unique.
That's unique. I'm the most calloused man in the world.
I can see you. What's your one unique thing? I am the one person in the world who survived the Tomb of Horrors, which means any trap you throw at me, I know exactly how to beat it and how to bypass it. So, yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah. I was the fifth Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. It's like, pit of spikes, bam, I'm in my shell, bitch.
I wore a red shirt to season 15. Yeah.
So, but I, honestly, that's nitpicking in this game. So, because they do it, and they have things like callouts, like players, they'll have like little advice for the players. So it's very very readable, very easy to follow,
very accessible. Yeah,
and you know, even things like if you're wondering why it'd be a good idea to subtract one from your natural result on your d20. You know, read Bard's Battle Cries or the Fighter's Flexible Attacks, blah, blah, blah.
That's in reference to the half-elf's special power allows them to subtract one from their roll. And when I was thinking this, why would you ever want to subtract one for your roll?
Right.
And the very next paragraph is, if you're wondering why you want to subtract one from your roll, go to this page.
You know,
page.
And right. I think, so. Again, this is, you see the experience here, because sometimes you're reading rules and you're like, you read it.
I don't get it.
And you're like, I don't get it. I know it makes sense. I know it's a benefit because they're presenting it as a benefit. I don't get why it's a benefit. And you see that. I'm planning my rebel squadron to fight Imperials in X-Wing miniatures. And, you know, you got to pick your powers. And you're like, okay, why is that a benefit? Is that good? You know, you got to, like, try to think, like, with experience in the game, why it's good. But if somebody's just reading this, you got to, like, explicitly tell them.
Right.
Okay, here's why this would be good. Or if you're not going to say it in that paragraph, say, look here, look here, look here, look here. And they do that.
Exactly.
The only thing about this are the dwarves getting a raw deal.
Yeah, I thought the same thing.
But I guess because everybody gets a bonus to their abilities. Of course, humans are +2 to wherever, and the other races are limited. Maybe half-elves are +2 to wherever. Then they get a racial power. Even humans get a racial power. And then you get a champion feat, and everybody gets that. But then everybody else seems to have an extra ability. For example, humans get a bonus feat. And elves have the adventure tier elf feat.
And then you also get your specific feat as to which kind of elf.
Yeah, yeah, and then you also get your racial power. Like, these are in addition to the same things that... But dwarves, no. But theirs is to do with recovery and healing. Mm-hmm. And it looks like half-orcs as well, they get... seem to be missing something, but they get the reroll melee attack. So are these racial powers considered better, so therefore they don't get that additional power, or what?
Yeah, that's something you actually have to play to find out.
Yeah, because I would, looking at this, I would think, okay, maybe the extra feat isn't as good as healing better or being able to reroll a melee attack, right? But then when I look at the elves and I said, if you use swords that deal d6 and d8 damage without attack penalties, you gain a +2 damage bonus. And I just think, I would think damage bonus would be good too. So, but maybe the d6, d8 damage without attack penalties is enough of a condition or a limitation that they think, okay, that's makes it weak enough.
Not sure.
No. But yeah, other than that, for people who are coming at it from a D&D perspective, it seems that the races have, at first glance, less powers. So when you look at an elf or you look at a dwarf, you have a certain list of all the powers, the special powers that an elf got and all the special powers that a dwarf got. And that's why the human had to get +1 to their skill, +1 feat, just to kind of balance it out.
Yeah, in 4E, the race got a whole page worth of stuff. But in this one, it's pretty much just a paragraph, if that.
Yeah.
But that said, you know, there's 20 pages on each class, so.
Yeah, so they're different. The races are different, but it's not more difficult to play an elf than it is to play a human, I guess. And maybe that gets into what they've done with the barbarian versus the wizard, whereas it's like the classes are kind of ranked in level of difficulty, whereas the races were like, hey, we don't want to make it more difficult to play a gnome.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought that.
So
it's possible. Because they also have like the tieflings and the dragonborn at the end, but they're kind of optional ones that you might want to put in, and their rules were a bit different too.
Right. I think they even have like something that's kind of like the equivalent of the Warforge too.
Yes, yes. A dwarven...
Something like a dwarven forge?
That's what it is.
Dwarf forge? I thought it was Forgeborn.
Both. Forgeborn, Dwarf forge. And the Dragonborn are Draconic or Dragonspawn. Then we got the Holy One, Essamar. These are all optional PC races. So the other ones are like halfling, half-elf, human... gnome, three types of elf, dark, high, and wood, one type of dwarf, half orc, those are the core, and then you get a few optional, as we said. There's a black and white picture of a dragon spawn and a forgeborn arm wrestling. Tieflings are tieflings or demon touched.
So all the 4E races are there, pretty much.
Yeah, like except for the crystal man, that's a big disappointment.
Oh, no loss there. What was that? You know what? Because I actually went on to the 13th Age G+ community, and hey, I didn't see a giant complaint about where are those crystal men?
Yeah, yeah. Hey, where are the plants that don't really speak to anybody, and we have no motivation? Where are those guys? Where?
Yeah.
Hey, remember the insect guys that have zero empathy? Where are they?
Oh, the three cream?
Yeah.
Oh, come on, they were cool.
Yeah, no, I think 13th Age could do an amazing job with Dark Sun.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
So as the clock nears 2 a.m., and that was all for you, listeners, all for you. Recommendations, strong recommendation, recommendation with conditions, or no recommendation for 13th Age?
I can't really recommend this game. No, I'm sorry. It's just, I'm just kidding. I really, 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 really want to give it a very strong recommendation because I think it's a great game. But I think it might come with the minor condition that it's great if you want to be in fantasy and play D&D. Because if you didn't like anything about 4E, this is a redo of 4E. And even though it's a great redo, if you didn't like 4E at all, then it might not hold that much for you. But really, that aside, it's a great looking game. And I want to give it a strong recommendation with only a very tiny condition on it.
Yep, I think that's pretty much the recommendation I was going to give. I don't know, but when I first started reading it, I wasn't all that impressed because it's just kind of more of the same typical fantasy stuff, and as Chris said, if you didn't like 4E, you probably won't like 13th Age, but after doing this, there is enough interesting stuff going on where I want to play it, and so I'm actually going to give it a strong recommendation with the caveat it's fantasy. I think recommendation
with I'm combining, you know.
No.
Hybrid.
Yeah, hey. Well, okay, whatever.
Well, wait, who's the guy who gave five games for his best three games?
Yes, thank you.
All right. I actually entered in with, I was going to give it a recommendation with a condition. And the condition is if you like 4E, then this is definitely the game. I changed my mind. I'm going to give this a strong recommendation. I do have concerns with the art and that's not a selling point. And I'd like to see more in future supplements that addresses that issue. But I think based on the system and icons only for the setting, I think that this is an exciting game to play and would be a fun game to play and is accessible. And I think that's really, really important in this day and age is a game that's pretty easy to pick up. And this seemed to be fairly accessible. And I would actually like to see what they would do with an introductory game on this. 13th Age is a worthy successor to Dungeons & Dragons. And if they can support it as much as Pathfinder, a nice would be a pretty decent competitor.
Yeah,
agreed.
So good luck to them. But yeah. I'll say this about Numenera is I gave it a recommendation with conditions. But if that's going to be unsupported, then no recommendation because that game lives or dies on the support. Whereas right. 13th Age is fairly compatible with 4th edition material. And you can actually do a lot with just this book. The system is that good, I think, in my opinion. Whereas Numenera, the system's good. But because they try to sell the setting so much, you're like,
The system is entwined with the setting. It's hard to separate the two.
Right.
All right. Well, so to wrap up the two parts, it seems like of the two games, 13th Age would be the one to buy if you're looking at that. We had the PDF versions of both, so we can't really comment on qualities that would be important to people who do buy print books, which we do, and such as binding, quality of the paper, and things like that. Unfortunately, we can't comment on that, but PDFs were pretty decent. The Numenera PDFs were a little bit more advanced and took advantage of what PDFs can do. 13th Age is kind of a basic PDF.
That being said, I guess I should have brought it up during the Numenera episode, but the Numenera PDF was $20, which is kind of beyond the max I would normally pay for a PDF, even a 400-page one. Yes, it was laid out nicely, and yes, it had those hyperlinks, but $20 for a PDF is a bit excessive, in my opinion.
That's what I'd pay for a PDF. Now, it doesn't really matter, neither here nor there. All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Idlered Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or stream it through Stitcher or iTunes or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. You can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com or join up in our forums and have a discussion there. We're being hosted by the guys at Happy Jacks. Thank you, as always, guys. And you can access that at idleredhands.com/forums. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Bedtime.
Yeah, what is that? Over 3 hours. Well, there's two episodes. Easy.
Yeah, yeah.
Drive Through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive Through RPG. The one true source for RPGs. We'll be right back.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.